welcome to the Vibrational Voyage radio program. Vibrational Voyage is about exploring the evolution of consciousness and the dynamics of global transformation. My name is Tony McGettigan, and I'll be your host for this journey. Alicia here in the studio with us. Now, I have to ask just to make sure I'm saying your first name right, because sometimes you know the spelling's strange or you don't get it right. Am I saying it right?
Alicia is absolutely correct.
Okay, terrific. Well, I have a little bit of biographical information here, so let's give a little introduction. You're a psychedelic research associate, and you've been working on a study, actually a couple of studies, it appears, but you've been co-facilitating sessions with Dr. Charles S. Graub for a Harbor UCLA trial since about 2005 up until 2008, using psilocybin to treat anxiety in patients with stage 4 cancer. And you're also a PhD candidate in transpersonal psychology. I guess clinical psychology, but it's a transpersonal. Is it a transpersonal program?
It's a transpersonal school at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology.
ITP, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, well, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here. I really appreciate you coming out at 11. It's not always easy to get folks to come into the studio.
No, thank you. I do my best thinking later at night.
No, well, and you seem your work kind of focuses in an adventurous area, so you're up for the adventure tonight too. Well, it's wonderful to meet you and to have you here tonight.
Thank you.
So we talked a little bit earlier. There was some. This work has developed for you over the last few years. It wasn't what your career was initially focused on. You were telling me that you worked as a project manager.
That's right.
Earlier.
That's right. This profession didn't exist when I started my career. Mm. Initially, I was a news and documentary producer for about 9 years.
Wow.
So I took a roundabout, unexpected route to mm-hmm. doing this work, but I don't think I'm the only one.
Well, and what was it that you were kind of explaining it to me a few minutes before we got started tonight. What was it that got your attention and really grabbed you, got your interest in this particular field of study and work?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying I'm probably one of the most unlikely people to be doing this work that you could ever meet. These days, we're getting messages on an almost daily basis from people all over the world who are studying medicine and psychiatry and psychology that are curious about how they could be doing psychedelic research. Mm-hmm. And they have the background that you would expect. I, however, had no personal or professional interest in psychedelics until I was well into middle age and had been working in one career for about 9 years and then in project management for another 9. And I started down this path when I became aware that some coworkers of mine were trying ecstasy. Mm. And when I first heard about that, I was so nervous because I knew nothing about it and I thought they were going to rot their brains.
Yeah.
And it was very typical of me to go get a book to read about it so I could tell them all about how horrible it was and in hopes that I could make them stop doing it. Mm-hmm. And I got a copy of Dr. Julie Holland's book, Ecstasy, A Complete Guide, and read it cover to cover. And there was a section in there from young men who had schizophrenia who had written to her about how helpful they had found their experiences with MDMA ecstasy. Mm. And it's just one of those moments in life where you read something that just broke my heart in an instant, because they talked about what it was like to regain that sense that they were, you know, fully human. Mm-hmm. And even though the symptoms of schizophrenia would return after the effects of the drug wore off, they retained something valuable, some knowledge about themselves and their connection to other people. Mm-hmm. And it was so powerfully moving to me. Something just went off in me like a switch, just in a heartbeat. And I asked myself, why can it be that there is this substance that can be so helpful to people who don't have many other good options? Why are they being denied this substance? And then I realized that researchers at reputable institutions with, you know, good credentials, good responsible researchers were prevented for legal reasons from even looking into potential benefits.
Yeah.
And it just seemed somehow unacceptable to me.
Yeah.
And I called Dr. Holland and said, you know, I'm a TV producer with some project management experience. Can I help? And she couldn't think of anything. She referred me to Rick Doblin, who was the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And I just got on the phone with him and said, I want to help. And he referred me to Dr. Grobe because I was in Los Angeles at the time. So that was the initial catalyst, just reading testimonials in a book.
Mm, that's pretty interesting. And I think your reaction is pretty strong. To me, it's one that I myself felt when I started to have my own experiences with things like ecstasy and psilocybin. It was like the effect is so profound. I cannot imagine that it's going to hit everybody exactly the same way. It seemed to have very, very much of a very personal impact in my own life and experience. You know, took me in directions in conjunction with that experience. But I thought, it's so profound. It's got to have some kind of profound effect on anybody who's trying it and they're open to it at all. So if this is the case, then why wouldn't it be much more well known? And why on earth would it be illegal?
It didn't make sense to me either.
Yeah.
Not at all. Just to continue how I started doing the work a bit further, the next step is kind of funny as well. I called Dr. Grobe with no medical background, no training in any mental health profession, and I just said, I really feel a call to help and volunteer. I do have other skill sets that may be helpful. And I talked to him a bit and kind of scratched his head. And in that conversation, we discovered that he did training. He would give ground rounds presentations on occasion and speak at the medical school at UCLA. And I found out that he was carrying around one of those old carousels of 35-millimeter slides in a beat-up old box that he carried on airplanes with him because he was so afraid of losing his slides.
Really?
And that was the foot in the door for me. I said, there's something called PowerPoint, and I think you need one for your presentation. And I just started volunteering for him, building PowerPoints for him, and did that for some time until Mary C. Haggerty, who was the RN, who was the original co-facilitator and research coordinator, she relocated to another city, and that vacancy became open. And someone put my name forth, like, what about Alicia? And it just clicked. The team was extremely generous about training me and making sure that I knew what to do on the clinical ward when we were working with study participants, and it just really took off from there.
Hmm. So what would your work entail generally? I mean, it's I know some of it was actually sitting with patients, but I imagine there's a lot of other legwork that goes into getting a study ready and, you know, talking to all the people that are necessary to talk to.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's similar to television production or project management in that there's kind of a pre-production phase where you're recruiting participants, getting the word out about the study, speaking to various you know, wellness center groups or, I mean, we did all sorts of things to try to find people who wanted to be in the study. At one point, I did kind of a grand tour of all the cannabis dispensaries in L.A. I'd go around with flyers and ask to speak to the manager and say, if you have any regular clients here who have advanced cancer, you know, you could let them know about this other study they might be interested in. When we found someone who expressed an interest, there was initial screening. There are always inclusion and exclusion criteria. Had to make sure that we weren't likely to do anything that could be harmful. Because this was the first study approved with human subjects using psilocybin.
It was the first official study?
Since psilocybin became a Schedule I substance in
like
the early
in the 70s.
Yeah, this was the first study in humans in the second wave of psychedelic research. So for good reason, and I absolutely think it should have been this way, the FDA was very strict about all the rules and regulations for this study. So our participants actually had to have an MRI of the brain to make sure there was no metastases in the brain.
Really?
We were ultra careful about safety. So finding people with advanced cancer who were healthy enough to participate was a challenge.
Yeah.
So there was an extensive kind of pre-screening and interviewing process that took place up front. And also, it's always a good idea with any psychedelic use to pay careful attention to what's commonly referred to as set and setting, and really helping the participant prepare to get in the proper mindset to identify why are you doing this, what kind of inner work do you hope to be doing, and which issues are, you know, important for you as you're preparing for dying, and helping participants get ready was part of that kind of pre-phase. And then you go into kind of what's the equivalent of production, where you're actually doing the research. That involved having participants come for two overnight stays in a clinical research facility. The study took place in a room that used to be a sleep lab, so it was nice and quiet, had a big, heavy double door. We'd just have one bed in there, and I would go in advance and decorate it with really beautiful fabrics, and we'd bring in flowers and try to make the environment more conducive to a good psychedelic experience, because that was usually the first thing people would ask me. They said, can we do this out in a meadow, or can we do this at the beach? And so we tried to make the hospital as psychedelic friendly as possible.
Not easy.
And because safety was foremost, this was primarily a feasibility and safety study, just to establish a real solid foundation for future studies. And the team would come in, you know, about 9 o'clock, 9:30 in the morning, check in with the participant. They would usually take either the psilocybin or placebo at around 10, have their experience over about 6 hours, and then they would go home that same day to gather data, which is always important in clinical research. They filled out various instruments or questionnaires, different surveys, collecting all sorts of information about their mood, anxiety, perceptions of pain, and so on. And everyone in this study was what we refer to as their own control. which meant that they had the active drug on one occasion and a placebo on another, but we never knew which was which. So that's what we said. It was blinded to us in that we didn't know. Mm-hmm. They just got a pill and some water to swallow it. Mm-hmm. But because these were people who were near death, it really wouldn't be ethical to say at the end of the study, oh, we're so sorry, you were in the placebo group.
Right. Yeah, so, and they would only get the placebo.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody had an opportunity to have the active psilocybin. And then the last phase is kind of the final data collection and follow-up. We checked in with everyone at least once a month for 6 months after the treatment session to help them with integration. If difficult emotional content came up during the session, two psychiatrists were available for consultation and integration support, which can be really vital for maximizing the potential benefit of a psychedelic experience, having someone to talk to and sort of talk through any challenging material or new insights.
So were some of those helpers, facilitators also experienced with the medicine themselves?
Such a great question, and we get asked it a lot. Here's how I answer that question. I can only speak for myself, but I will say, in the world of psychedelic research, the people who are conducting it now, some of them have had psychedelic experiences, some of them have not. Mm-hmm. I fall in the camp of researchers who sort of agreed that it's never in our best interest or the interest of the work to answer that question directly, because if we have had psychedelic experiences, we can be dismissed by half of our audience as being, you know, law-breaking people doing crazy drugs.
Right.
And, you know, the flip side is, well, if you've never done this, how do you know what you're doing, and how can you facilitate sessions for other people? Mm-hmm. So some people have been motivated who are doing the work because they have had very powerful, transformative experiences that they value, and some people are motivated because they see the profound potential to help others.
Well, it's a question that I've had to deal with from my own experiences, as I alluded to earlier. But the thing that I've been amazed by is that there's quite a variety of things that produce profound experiences. Of course, the kind of experience that you have with psilocybin, or even, you know, between different amounts of psilocybin or different types of psychoactive mushrooms. I mean, those are different qualities of experience. But I was equally amazed by the intensity and the profound effect of breath work. And I had what I would say is qualitatively, it had some different qualities, but it was just as profound and just as meaningful as any medicinal experience that I ever had. I'd say breath is a medicine, you know, after those experiences.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And that is one of the things that we recommend sometimes, because as I mentioned, we're getting lots and lots of mail from around the world from people who are finding this research very exciting, and they not only want to get involved as researchers, we get plenty of volunteers who want to be participants in studies. And at this time, we don't have any legal options with substances that we can refer, but we'll you know, remind people there are other ways to achieve altered states of consciousness, and that if it's available in their area, they might want to try some holotropic breathwork training, or you know, make a commitment to a meditation practice, or so there are other ways.
Definitely, and we've always had people in our societies, whether they be monks or yogis or adventurers, who have been available and more than ready to go and experience these things. But what's interesting to me is that in this time, and certainly going back for the last 50 years, but I think especially like right now, 2008, 2009, 2010, and hopefully further, it seems like there's a groundswell of interest and awareness and participation in types of experience that can lead us into a wider awareness of what's really going on here, which seems to be so important. Mm-hmm. Because if it's always the same old ideas, the same old awareness, the same old perceptions, then we're going to have always only the same old solutions. And we are in a situation now, it seems, that we need better solutions or more awareness, a wider range of possible solutions.
Yeah, I view psychedelics as just one of many options in that category of other solutions, other ways to receive inspiration or personal transformation or even collective shifts. It's so fascinating to me that some of the early chemists who had to make that very difficult decision to go underground and manufacture LSD did so because they were so profoundly affected by the introduction of the atomic bomb that they were willing to risk their professional careers and in some cases their personal freedom. They risked going to jail because they had such strong conviction that a substance like LSD could have a very liberating effect on human consciousness and help humanity see better, more peaceful ways of treating one another and treating the earth and so on.
Well, it sounds like that you have some insight into the history of how this stuff has kind of proliferated through humanity's experience. And if I remember correctly, what was the gentleman who synthesized LSD the first time? Was it Hoffman?
Hoffman.
Yeah, Albert Hoffman. Wasn't that, what year was that? Do you remember?
Oh, it was in the late 40s. I think somewhere between 47 and 49.
Because there was something that someone had mentioned to me once. They thought there was a really close correlation with the first use of atomic weapons and with the discovery of LSD. So they're in the ballpark there somewhere. And I'd heard maybe they were even much more closely timed.
Just a couple years. A couple years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, so that's interesting. You know a little bit about some of the people who were really touched and felt that it was necessary to use their technical skill in order to be proactive in moving the presence of LSD in the world forward. Do you remember? I mean, it's probably some things you've studied in the past, maybe some books you've read. Who were some of those people? Do you remember?
Oh gosh, there were people like Aldous Huxley, who wrote about his experiences with mescaline and his experience with that opening, that consciousness expanding, that had a real influence on his writing, his life as a writer and an intellectual. There's so many. Gordon Wasson was the mycologist who he and his wife just shared a common passion for mushrooms and sort of went adventuring around and hunting for different interesting kinds of mushrooms, and they became aware of the work of the curandera Maria Sabina down in Mexico, and they were some of the first people from outside of that culture to have those experiences with psychedelic mushrooms and came back and wrote about it. I guess it depends on which substance you're thinking about. But there were some very open-minded people. They kind of fell into two camps back then. There were those who, like Huxley and his contemporaries, who thought that even Hoffman was included in the camp, that thought that it was best to sort of keep these substances under wraps and kind of segregated to, you know, the intellectual elite, and that there would be this sort of trickle-down effect as well-educated people became, you know, familiar with the terrain, that these tools would become more widely known. And then you had people like Timothy Leary that had kind of a more populist approach and thought, we'll pull all of humanity up by dispersing these substances far and wide so that, you know, together it'll become part of the collective subconscious experience and we'll all... we'll all kind of ascend together. So yeah. There was sort of two camps for a while.
Yes. Well, and I had the pleasure to talk with Neil Goldsmith. I think you know Neil.
Yeah, I know Neil.
And it was just before the conference that happened in San Jose a few weeks ago. And I was very interested to get his perspective on, you know, what was happening now and how that was connected to what had happened in the 60s. And he had a nice analogy, and maybe you've heard this too, not only from him but other people as well, that it was like our society had been dosed, you know, unknowingly given a big dose of something, and that there was a very fearful reaction as a result. And that kind of helps to explain, you know, the effect and the reverberations that persisted for decades after the 1960s. And yet he observed that now we're standing in a place where we have had a chance to kind of take a different experience, a different view, and it's not evoking that kind of fearful response. Now, I'm sure for some people, the subject still evokes a very disturbed, fearful view of things. But I thought it was a very interesting view that he was expressing there, that we're standing in perhaps a different place and now with an opportunity to react differently or to treat these things in a different way. I thought that was interesting. So I'd love to see what your feelings are about where we stand now, maybe relative to where we stood 40, 50 years ago with respect to the experience, the impact of these substances.
Well, one thing that has changed since back then is most people know someone who has had an experience with a psychedelic, and they didn't go running wild in the streets. Mm-hmm. They lived to tell about it, and oftentimes what they had to report was that it was a positive experience for them, that it was somehow life-changing in a meaningful way. Mm. I think it's more... more scholarly work is published and more books are distributed in the mainstream. People become more aware of innovations such as the introduction of the internet and the environmental movement, advances in civil rights causes that can be attributed to these states of consciousness that provide this stronger awareness of the unity of humankind and our connection to the planet and other living things.
Yeah, well, it seems to give, you know, people who report from their experiences, and I've had some of these kinds of experiences myself, and I'm sure a lot of the people who are listening have had these kinds of experiences too. And there's two things about them that stand out. That it seems to open us up to, I'd say, the simplest way to put it would be other dimensions. you know, wider dimensions of our own being and of our experience. So there's kind of this inside-outside thing going on where there's more of us. We suddenly become aware there's more of us there than we realized, and there's more going on.
Yeah. I did a little research last year that I am just sort of wading into now. There's much more to be explored, but I became very curious about the fact that ketamine is wildly popular in Hong Kong.
Really?
It's more popular there than any of the other big cities where ketamine has made it into the club scene.
Really?
It is the drug of choice amongst a pretty wide section of working class young people in Hong Kong. I thought, why ketamine? And why is it taking off there and not in Amsterdam and London and L.A., San Francisco? And I thought, what is it about ketamine in Hong Kong? And I read some very fascinating studies about who's doing it, why they say they're doing it, and so on. And one little bit of information really stood out to me as fascinating. Psychedelics, the classic psychedelics that we think of, you know, psilocybin and LSD and so on, never caught on in Hong Kong, even though, you know, it's a major port city, all sorts of substances are going in and out all the time. There was access to them, but it didn't catch on in that culture. Well, what's with that? Why, if they could have had their own, you know, psychedelic revolution there, why didn't they? And I looked at a study that Charles Tart did back in the early 90s, where he distributed a survey to members of his Buddhist Sangha, a Tibetan Buddhist group, that he went to a retreat and distributed this survey. And these were primarily Bay Area, upper middle class, mostly Caucasian participants in this conference. And he was looking at how experiences with psychedelics influenced their decisions to practice Buddhism. And the data he came up with were fascinating. There was a strong correlation between, you know, people who had had a, you know, knock your socks off, see God kind of LSD experience, and the decision to pursue a deeper Buddhist practice. In other words, they'd had this altered state of consciousness, and they were looking for healthy ways to sustain some of these states of mind and to continue the growth without having to do a lot of drugs. This is just my personal theory, but I really thought what might be going on is, in Hong Kong, the young people live in a collectivist culture where they are extremely enmeshed in a collectivist web. Mm-hmm. I lived there for a year, so I'm somewhat familiar with the culture over there. You really don't have a real strong sense of identity outside of your role as someone in a family or a clan. Mm-hmm. And they refer to ketamine in one article as sitting down to float. And it really occurred to me that what they might be doing with ketamine is seeking out a very dissociative experience to individuate a bit and to kind of float above it and have some, you know, me time with their own psyche. Whereas in the West, when people talked about the experiences that they valued with psychedelics, it was kind of that crash course in Eastern ways of thinking.
More how we're connected.
Unity.
Yes.
And that sense of, you know, separation being an illusion and oneness with all creation, and these just foundational ideas of a lot of Eastern philosophies. And I'll probably spend the rest of my life researching this, but I think the human body, the human psyche, we're all so wise. We're always seeking health and healing and wholeness. And that interesting choice of substances, I could step back and see how people in the West were seeking that collective sense of unity with others, and people in the East were intuitively sensing that sense of individuation in the self.
That's interesting. I've never experienced ketamine myself. I'm just taking from what you say that it seems to produce some kind of a, you're saying floating, maybe even in a sense of an out of body type of experience. Is that kind of part of what it is reported?
Well, I can't speak from personal experience, so I can't tell you.
Yeah.
I've not experienced ketamine, but I have spoken to people who have.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a departure from ordinary default reality into what has been described to me as just kind of an internal world where you kind of detach.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think the choice of substance sometimes can be just a natural draw to experience that wholeness and get that human experience that we don't have in our everyday life so much.
Well, it is interesting. I just noticed from my own experience and from some of the things I observe in people I know. And I'm not a person who goes out seeking these things. I don't have a ton of connections, and I can't just go, you know, on any given day or weekend or whatever and just go find the stuff. It has to kind of show up. And it's interesting watching what shows up. And sometimes it's been years. I mean, I've literally had many years in my life where I was not even the least bit interested, and there was nothing around, and I didn't care. I was so very happy and focused in what I was doing and didn't feel the desire. And this was after I had initially had some pretty profound experiences, and there were just other things going on that I was really concerned about and focused on. But it's interesting what tends to show up and then what tends to take hold. And that's a pretty interesting observation about that one particular area and what seems to really take hold. So there's something in the experience there that you're observing that seems to kind of favor that particular type of thing. For a while, I guess LSD was the thing that was really, really much more available, especially here in the West and in the 60s in particular, probably in the 70s. And then, you know, now there's probably a much wider array of substances that are available. Certainly, I mean, since the work of Terence McKenna, a lot of people learned how to, or at least they know you could grow psilocybin mushrooms. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. And now the laws are changing, so it may be legal for people who don't use medical marijuana to be able to not only have marijuana but perhaps even cultivate it. So these times are definitely shifting around. We're in a time when things are really kind of moving. I'm just making that observation. It just seems like there's a lot of things, and in any particular place, in any particular time, that pattern seems to shift a bit, you know, for whatever. And of course, it differs by age group too.
Oh, yeah.
When I hear about what, you know, the kids are playing around with, and some of these things I don't even have any concept about. They're a bit more adventurous again than the people who have a few decades on them. So
I heard somebody say one time, every generation gets the drug it deserves, and it's kind of a fun one to play with.
What do you think is mostly happening, if there's any generalizations we can draw about what is going on for the young kids now? Do you know about, do you have any pulse on that?
Well, a lot of it depends on socioeconomic class, geographic region, what's available.
Yeah.
You can talk to some young people who'd say, you know, I'd love to be doing more LSD, I just can't find it. There's a lot of different factors that determine who's doing what and how much and how often. My focus has been almost exclusively on psychedelics and MDMA, so I'm not qualified to speak to street or recreational drugs in general.
Mm-hmm.
But one one area that's really interesting and may be an area for upcoming research in the not too distant future is the substance ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are drawn to the fact that in some areas it's possible to participate in legal religious ceremonies with a structure in place to really maximize security and potential benefit. There's kind of a community with guidelines and instruction around proper use that's intended to promote spiritual growth and spiritual pursuits.
Yes.
So that's one area that's fascinating to me, because I think most people would agree that there's a very low potential of ayahuasca ever becoming a party drug. So I can see why spiritual seekers are drawn to it, and it may make lawmakers a bit less nervous if it's used within a religious or spiritual context.
Well, it seems to me, because of the situation that we have with, it's basically illegal to even have the stuff, and you can get in trouble for even talking about it. Mm-hmm. In that situation, it kind of creates a vacuum for the people who have experiences. I mean, if we had more wisdom around this subject, we would have more like what you're talking about with this ayahuasca experience that's happening in some places, where people who have a healthy relationship to the medicine would be able to talk about it openly with other people who are interested. And so maybe you'd have much more of a healthy sort of spiritual or initiation type of atmosphere that exists around these things. Now, to me, it's amazing that that you don't have more problems, that we don't have more difficulties with these things as a result, because the effects are definitely, disturbing in some. I mean, even an immensely blissful experience is disturbing. It unsettles your life. It is not. It's not a common occurrence.
No, it's that peeling away of a veil that allows somebody to have a lived experience of other realities. That kind of can
other realities
rock your world.
Is the point, because for a long time that this idea was kind of sold to us. Oh, and even the words we used, it's hallucinatory, it's a hallucination. Well, thank goodness for the brilliance of people like Terence McKenna coming up with phrases like true hallucinations. I mean, because what you just said, I think, is a more adequate expression for it. These are other realities.
Yeah, and I'll go on record as saying hallucinogens don't cause hallucinations, mm-hmm. in the true sense. By definition, what they allow people to experience is altered perceptions, mm-hmm. which is different from a true hallucination.
Yeah.
So I try not to use the word hallucinogens, even though that's still the term that's used in the medical literature.
Okay.
I hope we move away from that soon.
Well, it's interesting, because then with ecstasy, that was the first time I ever came in contact with terminology like entheogen and entactogen. Mm-hmm. Now, those terms are, to me, immensely more, not only more beneficial and helpful, but more revelatory of the real nature of what those substances really are.
Yeah, one of the original terms for that class of drugs was empathogen, but some wise people somewhere thought that a drug with the word pathogen in it probably wouldn't go over so well. But, there really was an effort to come up with a name that spoke to that heart opening.
Yeah.
And are you feeling that connection with God? Are you feeling that connection with other people or even with yourself?
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine the terminology will continue to evolve as we become wiser about the substances. But
yeah,
the term hallucinogen just It had its place, but I hope it falls by the wayside.
No, I hear what you're saying, and I resonate with that. Mm-hmm. Now, you were saying that one of the things that you're also familiar with, either through study or through research, I don't know yet, mm-hmm. is MDMA. Mm-hmm. So what's been some of your learning and exploration with MDMA?
Well, when we were working on the psilocybin study, often participants would have eye shades on and have headphones, and there'd be sometimes hours would go by where we would have very minimal verbal contact with them, and we'd be sort of sitting there thinking, where are we going with this? What's next in psychedelic research? Who else might benefit from this? So I've been thinking about it for some time, and it occurred to me that there is a population who has, they've never been participants as a group in psychedelic research, you know, not back in the day, because their condition hadn't been identified yet, and that's individuals on the very high end of the autism spectrum who have Asperger's syndrome. And it's commonly perceived, I think, maybe wrongly, as a lack of empathy. And here's a substance that at one time they were considering calling it empathy. Well, why haven't these two come together? This seems like that's a logical field of research. So my dissertation work will be a qualitative study looking at potential benefits of introducing MDMA as a supplement to treatment for Asperger's, which is not the same as treating the Asperger's. People with Asperger's, often if you ask them and say, you know, if I had an injection I could give you that would make your Asperger's go away, would you want it? And quite often they'll say, no, I like the part of me that's autistic. I have access to this amazing world. I like being wholly absorbed in one area of interest that fascinates me, and I don't need that neurotypical emotional connection to other people. I don't want to get rid of my Asperger's. I want to get rid of the social discomfort of having to function in the neurotypical world where I don't understand the social conventions. So when people with Asperger's seek treatment, it's usually for conditions that co-present, such as anxiety and social phobias and depression, conditions like OCD or substance abuse or aggression problems, because it's so difficult for them to function when they can't read facial expressions in the way that we can. They don't understand body language or social cues. They don't oftentimes just the idea of constructing a lie is so foreign to them. They're very literal and logical thinkers. So what could possibly be helpful is having that empathic opening to help them understand, have a sense of what empathy feels like. And I started just doing research and digging up testimonials. I mean, that's kind of where you start with the anecdotal, you know, information that's out there. Has anybody ever had a transformative experience? And just like the testimonials I read that got me started in this research, I was coming across things that just made me cry. People describing what it was like to feel what they called true empathy for the first time, and then be aware that as the drug wore off, that, you know, profound sensation went away, but some individuals are able to retain that awareness of how their actions influence others, and they consider themselves, you know, better people for having had that experience. So I'm very curious about just gathering, doing, you know, field study, gathering data about how MDMA has been helpful, or also if it's been harmful in any way. What is it like to have that opening and then have that door closed?
Yeah.
It can be, you know, very depressing.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to keep in mind when we're thinking about potential treatments, how do you maximize the benefit and minimize any harm? So
yeah.
Looking into that.
Well, and after you, the story we started out with here at the beginning of the hour was how you kind of got yourself immersed in this to begin with, and you were so concerned about your friends. Are there any concerns that you have about your friends or about anybody who's consuming MDMA today, considering some of it sometimes comes from impeccable resources and is very pure, and sometimes it's not even ecstasy? I'm wondering if maybe you have some insight or words of wisdom to kind of speak to, you know, the challenge that we have with things that are produced, you know, in a powder. You know, that is, it concerns me. I've been a beneficiary of that molecule, and I have to say it's one of the most greatest blessings. But I'm concerned, and, you know, when I talk to my own kids about it, I say, look, you know, if you don't know for certain where this comes from, you should not be consuming it. So I'm sure you probably would echo that kind of concern as well. But I'm wondering what particular, you know, from being at least somewhat aware of what's going on with the stories, the anecdotes, and the literature, what would you say about the state of affairs with ecstasy?
Yeah, well, when I'm asked about it, when people assume that, you know, I have a big closet full of MDMA at home, I tell them, you know, unfortunately, the way things worked in this country, with the door being slammed shut on responsible research and MDMA becoming a Schedule I drug, which is the most prohibitive class, that it's very difficult to know what you're getting on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And the purity levels rise and fall over the years. There are times when, you know, word has it that the stuff you can get on the street is very pure and clean. And then you hear stories about adulterated product. So I tend to be conservative and caution people and say, at this point in time, regrettably, we're living in a country with laws that make it difficult to find out if stuff you already have is even MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have effective harm reduction.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't, you know, readily available, reliable resources for people to test pills or, you know, I tend to echo your feelings as well. If you don't know what you have.
Yeah. It's good to know where it comes from, and not just somebody told me it was good, but...
Yeah, everybody says, oh, yeah, pure MDMA. If you listen to what people say out there, you'd think everything was pure MDMA. So I'm not sophisticated enough to know how the stuff you'd get on the street is. I don't know how one would go about determining if it was really as pure as they think it is. So,
yeah, years ago there was an organization called DanceSafe.org. I don't know if they're still around.
Yeah.
But they had testing, and they would do testing at events, or they would sell you kits so you could test what you had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real simple color. You know, if it was blue, it was pretty pure. If it wasn't so blue, if it was yellow or orange, it was not so pure.
Yeah. When the laws changed, you know, about penalties that club owners could be subjected to, and
right,
so on, if people became, and understandably so, very cautious about, you know, getting busted and for having, you know, appearing to be lenient about drugs being used in their establishments. So,
yeah.
I've been really fortunate to, you know, my experience really has been confined to a clinical setting where we're working actually with synthesized psilocybin that is as pure as you can get. Some people have certain biases against synthesized.
It doesn't
substance.
Come from a plant
it,
source.
It doesn't come from a plant, therefore it's no good. But Maria Sabina herself, she had an experience to have synthesized psilocybin, and she made a comment that I guess loosely translated was something along the lines of, you know, well, the little people are in there. So, and some of the participants in our study who have tried both confirmed that, it's like a mushroom experience, but gentler on the body.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, do you have to rush off? Because Michael's coming in, but he's not back yet, so we could go for a few more minutes.
Oh,
does that sound fine?
Oh, sure.
All right, we'll take a break with music for just a few minutes. You're listening to the Vibrational Voyage program. We normally wrap it up at midnight, but I think we're going to get a couple extra minutes tonight. And if you'll stay tuned, we'll be right back.